Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The United States has confirmed that Iran has intercepted a commercial cargo ship in Iranian waters and is sending a ship and aircraft to observe interaction. Pentagon spokesman says the Marshall Islands flagship, the Maersk Tigris, was in Iranian territorial waters when Iranian patrol vessels approached it. The Maersk was directed by Iranian officials to proceed deeper into Iranian waters but declined, prompting one of the Iranian vessels to fire shots across its bow. The spokesman said the Maersk then complied with the Iranian order. People in earthquake-hit Nepal were in desperate need of water and other basics Tuesday as rescue workers and humanitarian groups continued trying to reach the country and those buried under rubble. The United Nations said the disaster has affected 8 million people, with 1.4 million in need of food aid. Officials said Tuesday the death toll had climbed to more than 4,300 people, with about 8,000 others injured. Many people spent another night sleeping outside or in tents, with aftershocks still shaking the region. VOA correspondent Steve Herman, who was in Kathmandu, said traveling to the capital city was not a problem Tuesday, but reaching outlying areas remained a challenge.
The big concern are for villages closer to the epicenter, and there's no way to get to these places by road. The only way to get there is by helicopter, and we're getting reports of villages that, you know, this village had 500 people, another village had 1,000 people, and just numerous villages like that that have been flattened.
Saturday's earthquake struck 80 kilometers northwest of Kathmandu. This is VOA News. The governor of the eastern U.S. state of Maryland says Baltimore will not have another repeat of Monday's night's violence. Riots erupted in the city after the funeral for 25-year-old Freddie Gray, an African-American man who died in police custody earlier this month. "It's not going to happen tonight," Governor Larry Hogan told reporters Tuesday. "We're going to make sure we get Baltimore back on track," said Hogan, stressing that the main goal is to make sure the city is brought back to peace. U.S. President Barack Obama echoed Hogan's comments Tuesday. "There is no excuse for this kind of violence," said Mr. Obama in remarks at the White House. "It's counterproductive." But he also made this comment.
"The violence that happened yesterday distracted from the fact that you had seen multiple days of peaceful protests that were focused on entirely legitimate concerns of these communities in Baltimore, led by clergy and community leaders, and they were constructive and they were thoughtful, and frankly didn't get that much attention."
National Guard troops deployed across the city after the governor declared a state of emergency. U.S. President Barack Obama welcomed Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to the White House Tuesday for a state visit, with the two leaders saying their country's alliance has never been stronger. Mr. Obama said that the United States and Japan, once World War II foes, have an indestructible partnership and are true friends.
"The United States has renewed our leadership in the Asia Pacific. Prime Minister Abe is leading Japan to a new role on the world stage. The foundation of both efforts is a strong U.S.-Japan alliance."
Mr. Abe described the U.S.-Japanese alliance as more robust than ever, and said Tokyo would be at the forefront with the U.S. in confronting global challenges. Before their remarks, the two leaders viewed U.S. troops on a sunny day in Washington and then shook hands with many of the hundreds of people gathered for the ceremony. Their talks are expected to focus on expanding bilateral defense and economic ties before they hold a joint news conference. Indonesia is making final preparations for the execution of 9 convicted drug traffickers, including 8 foreigners, despite fierce protests from international rights groups and also from world leaders. Officials have not given an exact time for the executions, but on Saturday they gave the prisoners a 72-hour notification of their deaths, which is required by Indonesian law. Again, Indonesia making final preparations for the execution of 9 convicted drug traffickers. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
And welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib. And coming up at this hour on Africa News Tonight,
thousands of refugees are fleeing Burundi as tensions over the upcoming presidential election heat up. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports the number of Burundians crossing into Rwanda has increased sharply, with more than 5,000 arriving in the past 2 days.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he believes the escalating trafficking of thousands of migrants from North Africa to Europe is the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Angola, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, protests continue for a third day in Burundi over President Pierre Nkurunziza's attempt for a third term in office. Six people are reported to have died since Sunday in clashes with police. However, Burundian government spokesperson Gervais Abayeho says police strongly deny involvement in the death of the protesters. He says during such demonstrations, it is not clear who is doing the shooting. The spokesman also says at least 30 police officers have been wounded. The ruling party, the CNDD-FDD, nominated President Nkurunziza to run for re-election. The party maintains that technically he has only served one elected term in office because members of parliament and not the voters elected him the first time. The government has banned demonstrations and has deployed many police and army troops. They've used tear gas and water cannons against the protesters. AFP reports that some of those killed were shot at close range. Also, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has dispatched the special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Burundi. Ban has condemned the violence and called for those responsible to be held accountable.
The group Human Rights Watch is calling for police restraint and freedom of the press in Burundi as violent political protests there continue. Karina Tetraskini is HRW senior researcher on Burundi from London. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa earlier today about the situation.
We're concerned about a crackdown that has been intensifying since Sunday, so since the demonstration started against President Pierre Nkurunziza standing for a third term. We're concerned, first of all, about the arrest of the country's most prominent human rights defender, Pierre Claver Mbonimpa. He was arrested yesterday, and you may recall he'd already been arrested last year and held in prison for several months. So he was arrested yesterday. He's still in detention today, and he's currently held by the intelligence services completely illegally, and he's been denied access to his lawyers this morning.
Do you know if any charges have been filed against him?
We have absolutely no idea. We've not seen any official documents. The authorities have not divulged any official charges against him. And even though last night he was detained at the police and he was due to be questioned by the prosecutor this morning, instead what has happened is that they've transferred him back to the intelligence services where no one was able to see him this morning. In addition to that, we're very concerned about restrictions on the media. So yesterday, the government completely shut down the broadcast of the most popular radio station in Burundi, RPA, Radio Publique Africaine, and they've also restricted the broadcast of two other stations, Radio Isanganiro and Radio Bonesha, limiting their broadcasts outside the capital. And this is really serious because in Burundi, of course, people in the countryside depend entirely on the radio for news. And the events that are going on right now affect everyone in the country. So the government is depriving the population of their very basic right to information.
Human Rights Watch also says that police in Burundi should be given strict instructions to avoid excessive force.
Well, there are very clear international guidelines on the use of force by law enforcement officials. It should be proportionate, and lethal force should only be used as a last resort. We've been receiving reports over the last couple of days of people who've died during the clashes, at least two people who were shot dead, many others injured. Now, the government has been saying that they're facing an insurrection, is the term that they use. But as far as we know, the protesters are not armed with weapons. Some of them have been throwing stones at the police, it's true, and have been burning tires in the streets and trying to force the police away. But the use of force by the police does appear, as far as we can tell, in some cases, to have been disproportionate. So we're calling on the Burundian authorities to do everything possible to calm the situation, to avoid inflaming it, and to allow people to exercise their right to peaceful protest.
Are you calling on the international community to do anything?
Well, yes, we're asking particularly the governments that support Burundi, the donors, the UN and others who are closely following the situation, to keep up the pressure on the Burundian government to allow people to express themselves and to participate in the democratic process. Elections are due to begin in May, but with the current situation, it's very difficult to imagine how people are going to be able to vote freely, for example. Now, a number of foreign governments, the US government, some European governments have put out some quite strong public statements appealing for calm, appealing for the Burundian government to allow people to exercise their rights. We hope that they will continue to put out such statements and to impress upon the Burundian government the importance of calming the situation in terms of the future of the democratic process in Burundi.
Karina Tertsakian is HRW senior researcher on Burundi from London. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa.
Thousands of refugees are fleeing Burundi as tensions over the upcoming presidential election heat up. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports the number of Burundians crossing into Rwanda has increased sharply, with more than 5,000 arriving in the past 2 days. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
UNHCR spokeswoman Ariane Rumery says the influx of 5,000 new refugees in just 2 days is a cause for concern.
They are basically mainly women and children, and they are saying that they experienced intimidation and threats of violence, which is linked to the upcoming elections in Burundi. Last Saturday, the official list of candidates to run in the Burundian presidential elections on 26th of June was announced, and this had sparked demonstrations and violence in the nation's capital.
Protests continued for a third day Tuesday in the Burundian capital, Bujumbura. People are venting their anger at the decision of President Pierre Nkurunziza to run for a third term, which they say is unconstitutional. The International Committee of the Red Cross reports 6 people have been killed since Sunday. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is planning to send a special envoy to talk with the Burundian president as concerns grow about violence spiraling out of control. There are unconfirmed reports that the majority Hutu are targeting minority Tutsi. Another UNHCR spokeswoman, Karen de Gruul, tells VOA she has no information about this. She adds she does not have an ethnic breakdown of the refugees who have fled to Rwanda, where it is prohibited to indicate and register people by ethnicity.
Well, the refugees themselves are telling us that they are being targeted because they're part of the opposition. They're being targeted by youth groups aligned by, or at least with links to the current government. That's what they are telling us. We can't confirm that at this stage, because you can imagine with so many people coming in, registering, transferring, taking care of people, making sure they have their basic needs, the situation is quite chaotic at the moment.
De Gruul says the UNHCR fears the violence in Burundi might continue, prompting an even bigger exodus. She says the Rwandan government is preparing for up to 50,000 arrivals, but that number could go higher. In the 1994 Rwandan genocide, Hutu radicals killed around 800,000 Tutsi and Hutu moderates. Over the next decade, more than 300,000 people died in the civil war between Tutsi and Hutu. Hutu in Burundi. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Fifteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he believes the escalating trafficking of thousands of migrants from North Africa to Europe is the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. The UN head boarded an Italian naval vessel yesterday and said, due to political instability in some parts of Africa, particularly North Africa, this sea has sadly become a sea of tears, a sea of misery. Much of the trafficking has impacted Italy, which has rescued more than 200,000 migrants from Mediterranean waters in more than 2 years. In a courtroom in Catania, an Italian court convicted 20 Somalis of international migrant smuggling. Another 32 members of the same gang of smugglers were convicted in other Italian courts. Testimony indicates smugglers of migrants recruit customers in refugee camps and earn large sums of money for the illegal activity. The UN estimates the migrant smuggling has netted traffickers more than $150 million a year. Itaya Viriri of the International Organization for Migration says criminal gangs from around the world are attracted to the illegal migrant trade because the profits probably rival those of the drug trade.
Well, male circumcision has been proven to slow the spread of HIV/AIDS in Africa, but a new study shows that in the short term, the surgical technique could actually increase the risk of infection for female partners unless precautions are taken. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization says male circumcision can greatly reduce the risk of HIV infection, and major campaigns are underway to get nearly 29 million men circumcised. Dr. Aaron Tobin and his colleagues are studying the effects of circumcision. He's an associate professor at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University.
Three randomized trials, which are the gold standard of medical evidence, have shown that male circumcision decreases HIV acquisition by 50 to 60% in men. And follow-up studies have shown that the procedure may be even more efficacious than that 50 to 60% efficacy.
He says male circumcision has other health benefits as well.
Male circumcision of HIV-infected men has also been shown to decrease genital ulcers and human papillomavirus. Among HIV-negative men, male circumcision has also been shown to decrease genital herpes and human papillomavirus, which is the cause of penile cancer.
Dr. Tobin says women benefit, too, when their male partner is circumcised.
Among female partners married to circumcised men, it's been shown that they have lower levels of bacterial vaginosis, trichomoniasis, and human papillomavirus that causes cervical cancer.
The procedure also provides some protection for women by reducing their exposure to HIV from their male partners. However, Tobin says, scientists studying HIV-infected men in Uganda have discovered something unexpected and worrying about the procedure. There is a greater risk of infection for women in the short term.
Among circumcision of HIV-infected men, there were numerous observational studies that suggested male circumcision prior to puberty, during childhood, may decrease HIV transmission. However, one randomized trial of circumcision of adult men showed that there's an increased HIV transmission to female partners if couples resumed intercourse prior to certified wound healing.
Dr. Tobin says it takes 4 to 6 weeks to fully heal from male circumcision.
HIV shedding significantly increased compared to prior circumcision at week 1, week 2, and week 3. So in the first few weeks after circumcision, HIV shedding significantly increased. However, by week 6 and by week 12, HIV shedding was actually significantly lower than compared to prior to circumcision.
Shedding is a term used, for example, when the virus is present in bodily fluids, such as semen or vaginal secretions. Tobin says while men are counseled not to have sexual intercourse during healing, many are nevertheless. So they are given condoms along with counseling. Now, the study shows that the likelihood of HIV transmission from a newly circumcised man to his female partner is less than 0.1%. That sounds rather small. However, the study warns that since the World Health Organization aims to circumcise nearly 29 million men in the coming years, that small increase could add up to 17,000 new infections among female partners. The Johns Hopkins associate professor does add that antiretroviral drugs can be a major mitigating factor.
Among those men who reported chronic antiretroviral therapy, they had significantly lower rates of HIV shedding during this entire wound healing period. It is about 90% lower than among those men who were not reporting antiretroviral therapy.
The study recommends that men be placed on antiretroviral therapy at the time of circumcision. However, it's not known yet how long the therapy should last or which drugs are the most effective in such cases. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In Nigeria, President-elect Muhammadu Buhari has announced Boko Haram as a bogus religious group. The former general vowed last night to take a hard line against the Islamist extremists as the military reported the discovery of an estimated 400 civilian bodies in the town of Damasak in Borno State. In a statement prepared by his all-progressive Congress Party, Buhari said, "Boko Haram are terrorists, and we're going to deal with them as we deal with terrorists." Buhari takes office on March 29th. The decomposing bodies of men, women, and children were buried in 20 mass graves on Saturday, more than a month after Chadian troops had first liberated the town. For several months, Damasak had served as central command for Boko Haram's campaign to take control of Borno and to other states as a caliphate. Upon their arrival on March 9th, the Chadian military discovered more than 100 bodies in a mass burial under a bridge in the town. Survivors at the time claimed more than 400 residents had been abducted as Boko Haram forces fled the town. The insurgents denied any abductions. On Saturday, one of the men who helped with the burials told the French news agency the bodies were found in houses, streets, and the dried-up Damasak River. The state government has not estimated the death toll. Meanwhile, Niger government officials in Niamey report they have regained control of Karamaga Island in Lake Chad. This after a surprise assault on a military base there by Boko Haram fighters in motorized canoes. In January, Niger joined a regional force to defeat the extremist forces that have killed thousands and displaced more than 1.5 million civilians in northern Nigeria.
In Washington, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, MCC, recently launched its energy-focused investment outlooks for three African countries, Ghana, Malawi, and Tanzania. The event also highlighted general investment opportunities and the economic climate of the countries. Participating in the panel discussion event was Ghana's Minister of Finance and Economic Planning, Seth Turper. I asked him if Ghana was ready to call itself Africa's economic powerhouse.
Ghana has just become a lower middle income country with economic prospects coming out of an expanding services sector and oil and gas, you know, which we have plans, particularly the gas element, to turn into power within context of our own power plan, as well as you may be aware, regional and global initiatives, you know, such as Power Africa and our compact too with the U.S., which we signed recently, which is focused heavily on the power or energy sector. So putting all this together, the economy was growing, suffered some setbacks. We are doing correction. We just entered into an IMF program to consolidate those efforts. So going forward, we have plans certainly to grow the economy and in the near future, yes, hopefully become a powerhouse, but we will be complacent in describing ourselves as such at this stage.
For this year, what would you say are the biggest investment opportunities in Ghana, and how are you going about attracting international investors?
The biggest attraction for foreign investments, and I must say in particular U.S. investments, including giants like General Electric, are in the power sector, as I said. And to provide a context, Ghana discovered oil and gas, and we have two gas fields coming on stream. And we came up with a policy not to flare gas or to re-inject gas. And therefore, the state led the initiative with pipelines, followed by a power processing plant, you know, which has become operational. But we realized also that the investment opportunities are greater than the state alone. We have a number of private investors coming in, independent power producers in particular, to harness that gas and possibly also to do some refining. So LNG and gas are really the areas where we are focused. And let me mention in this context, as I said earlier on, that the biggest initiative is the Compact 2, the Millennium Challenge Corporation of the U.S., you know, which is leveraging that compact. But besides the power sector, there are opportunities in transportation in particular. Accra is uniquely placed to be a hub for transportation. We have seen the airline industry grow rapidly. Similarly, we are expanding our port facilities, which will provide barging and other opportunities over the Volta Lake for the landlocked countries. And alongside this, we have an expanding services sector. In fact, the largest sector of economy is services, contrary to the belief that it's natural resources. And we are beginning to see some serious engagements by multinational, particularly in the financial sector.
Now, these are really some great opportunities that you are listing here. So where do women fit in helping to grow Ghana's economy?
Yeah, thanks to a very early pragmatic education, women play a very active role. When you come to Ghana, there are women CEOs, women ministers. In fact, one of my deputies is a woman. And when you get to the SME sector, obviously, women dominate.
What would you say are the biggest challenges right now in your Partnership for Growth initiative?
We just finished a joint meeting in Accra, and it's been followed by the midterm assessment. I would say to date, it has been very beneficial. As you may be aware, it's not just about power. As I said, there is the finance element, which is focused on credit analysis, including some fiscal analysis, and the SME sector, which I alluded to earlier. And these are concrete projects. These are not just concepts. We're talking about very, very concrete projects along the whole value chain for power, you know, in particular. So it's a very productive engagement with the U.S., and we are proud to be one of only a few countries to be part of this initiative. And we look forward to enriching it through the assessment that is ongoing now.
That was Seth Turper, Ghana's Minister of Finance and Economic Planning. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Protests continue for a third day in Burundi over President Pierre Nkurunziza's attempts for a third term in office. And President-elect Muhammadu Buhari vows to take a hard line against the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. Coming up, we'll have music from Angola. And in our feature segment, children being forced to beg on the streets of Dakar. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Uhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And welcome back, Sunny.
Thank you, Kim.
Well, I understand you're beginning with boxing.
Kim, we're now only 4 days away to the so-called fight of the century.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
Listen, when you're talking about the best fighter, you're talking about Floyd Mayweather.
Floyd Mayweather faces Manny Pacquiao Saturday night in a welterweight showdown at the MGM Grand Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's a mega bout that's been 5 years in the making, and it's expected to be the highest grossing fight in history. Our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta, says when the final count is tallied, the fight could bring in between $400 million and $500 million. Mayweather will get 60% of the purse, and the Pac-Man gets the remaining 40%. Floyd Money Mayweather has won all 47 of his prize fights with 26 knockouts. The Filipino star Pacquiao, meanwhile, has a professional record of 57 wins, 5 losses, and 2 draws with 38 knockouts. The 38-year-old Mayweather and the 36-year-old Pacquiao have been the biggest draw cards of their generation. And while they might be a few years past their prime, there is still tremendous interest in the fight. The two boxing champions held their one and only news conference last month at the Nokia Theater in Los Angeles. The first fighter to the podium was the Pac-Man, and he was introduced by his promoter, Bob Arum.
He is a fierce fighter who doesn't quit, who gives its all, and will bring his best on May 2nd. I present to you now the WBO welterweight champion of the world, Manny Pac-Man Pacquiao.
Thank you, Bob. And I would like to thank God for giving us and providing us a wonderful day, a beautiful day, and giving us strength. I believe that is what are you waiting for since 5 years ago. So I think the fight is on and you're very excited. I know you're very excited, and we're both of us, we're going to undergo a hard training for this fight. And we will do our best on May 2 to make you happy.
I'm sure Manny Pacquiao will be very happy if he becomes the first prize fighter to beat Floyd Money Mayweather, who was introduced at the Los Angeles news conference by promoter Leonard Ellerbe.
This next man, he really doesn't need any introduction. He's been pound for pound the best fighter in the world for many, many years. He's 47-0 with 26 knockouts. He's beat everybody in the sport. Come May 2nd, it will be no different. He's the current WBC welterweight and super welterweight champion. He's the WBA unified welterweight champion. And he's also the WBA super champion in the super welterweight division. He's been named the world's highest paid athlete by Forbes magazine, ESPN the magazine, and Sports Illustrated, which is truly a testament to his great popularity around the world. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce the pound for pound best fighter on this planet, none other than Floyd Money Mayweather.
May 2nd, the fight of the century. It's all about the best fighting the best. And Pacquiao is one of the best fighters of this era. And everything's about timing. I think we couldn't choose a better time. Our game plan is just to be smart and take one fight at a time, like all 47 fights. This is an unbelievable matchup. Action-packed fight. I'm in the gym working right now, dedicating myself to the sport, pushing myself to the limit, because I never wanted to win a fight so bad in my life. And I'm pretty sure he's going to push himself to the limit. He wants to win the same way I want to win. May 2nd, that's when the world stops. I want everyone to tune in. Mayweather Pacquiao, the biggest fight in boxing history. Thank you.
That's Floyd Money Mayweather, who will fight Manny Pacquiao on May 2nd in a blockbuster welterweight bout. Boxing fans all over the world are licking their chops in anticipation of this one, including my friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on. This is for the world. Just come out and play with me.
This is for the
globe. Just come out and play with me.
This is for the world.
Just come out and play with me.
This is for the
globe.
This is for the world.
Just come out and play with me.
This is for the globe.
Just come out and play with me.
This is for the world.
Just come out and play with me.
This is for the globe.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. I mentioned the big money at stake in the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight. Well, there's also some big money at stake at this year's Wimbledon Tennis Championships. The men's and women's singles champions will each receive the same prize of almost $3 million U.S. dollars, a 7% overall increase. During a news conference Tuesday at Wimbledon, All England Club Chairman Philip Brooke had this to say.
I think without the world's best tennis players, we wouldn't have the world's best tennis tournament. And we recognise that the players are an essential ingredient of our championships. And this level of prize money is affordable for these championships. And therefore, we feel it's important that we should reflect that in what we pay the players. So it's against that background, and on top of very significant increases over the past 3 years, that we are today announcing another generous increase of 7% in total prize money. So that will take our prize money up by 1.75 million and to a new level of 26.75 million overall. And I should add that after announcing record prize money in 2013 and 2014, at 26.75 million, Wimbledon prize money will again be the highest prize money ever in professional tennis.
That's Philip Brooke, the chairman of the All England Club, speaking Tuesday at Wimbledon. The prestigious Grand Slam tennis tournament gets underway June 29th and goes through July 12th. The defending men's and women's singles champions are Novak Djokovic of Serbia and Petra Kvitova of the Czech Republic.
The Voice of America.
VOA.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody.
From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. Joining us now with more sports news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
We begin with football. Hosts Ghana beat Liberia 2-0 in the opening leg of their men's 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympic qualifier played in Tamale on Sunday. Elsewhere, Botswana mauled their Kenyan visitors 3-0 in Lobatse, while Rwanda beat Somalia 2-0 in Kigali. Turning to athletics, Pierre Fermac triumphed in the boys' 10,000-meter race walking to open the floodgate of gold medals South Africa amassed on the final day at the Africa Youth Athletics Championships in Redouit, Mauritius on Sunday. Other gold medals came from Gift Lotlela in 200 meters, Henry Van Furen in javelin, and the boys' medley relay. In the girls' events, Nicola De Brain triumphed in 200 meters, as did Talone Bild in discus. Senegal's Fatou Badji, Nigeria's Olude Fadakemi, and Namibian Sylvia Schultz won the girls' triple jump, 5-kilometer race walking, and heptathlon, respectively, while Kenyan Kipyego Bett and Vincent Kilel won the boys' 800 meters and triple jump, respectively. Staying in Redouit, South Africa are the new Africa Youth Athletics champions. They topped the medal table at the end of the four-day contest with 17 gold, 6 silver, and 6 bronze medals. Kenya is second, while defending champions Nigeria are placed third. They are followed by Botswana, Algeria, Egypt, Madagascar, Mauritius, Namibia, while Rwanda and Senegal are tied in 10th place. Zambia is 12th, followed by Zimbabwe, Uganda, Seychelles, Gambia, Eritrea, and the Comoro Islands. Meanwhile, Kenyan defending champion Ezekiel Kipto Chebi retained his rock and roll Madrid Marathon title in the Spanish capital on Sunday. Fellow Kenyan Monica Jepkoech won the women's race. Elsewhere, Ernest Ngeno and Helena Kirop secured a Kenyan sweep in the men's and women's event at the Yellow River Estuary Marathon in Dongying, China. In Britain, Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge won the London Marathon.
I was a little bit scared, but I was very careful in 40 kilometers. I know Wilson will go automatically in 40 kilometers, but I was confident that I will go with this race.
Eliud Kipchoge won Sunday's London Marathon in a time of 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 42 seconds. He won a thrilling sprint finish against fellow Kenyan Wilson Kipsang, who finished 5 seconds back. And marathon world record holder Dennis Kimeto made it a Kenyan sweep of the podium by finishing third. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, health and aid officials say malnutrition is on the rise in South Sudan. And next, children being forced to beg on the streets of Dakar. But first, some music from Angola. Here is Oliver Ngoma with Bane. from Angola, Oliver Ngoma with Barney.
Well, Yahya's health officials say malnutrition is on the rise in South Sudan, and not just in areas that have been hard hit by 16 months of fighting. Wahi Simon Wudu visited clinics for malnourished adults and children in an IDP camp in Unity State and at a hospital in Juba. Wudu reports that officials are desperate for long-term solutions to the problem of hunger in South Sudan.
Panyijar County in southern Unity State has been hard hit by the 16-month-old conflict in South Sudan. Thousands of internally displaced persons or IDPs have come to the county to seek shelter from fighting. Many of them are children aged 5 and younger. They are particularly vulnerable to severe malnutrition and its long-lasting impacts. Panyijar County is controlled by rebel forces loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. The nearly 100,000 people, including IDPs, living here survive on basic commodities supplied by aid agencies. Darlene Raphael is the World Food Program Head of Nutrition in South Sudan. She says a survey conducted by aid partners found that 32% of children in Panyijar suffer from moderate to severe acute malnutrition. The WFP is the sole source of food for most people in Panyijar. The UN agency distributes 4 kilograms of food items per person each month in the county. A hungry young child cries at Ganiel Nutrition Center. The center is one of very few medical facilities in the county. It is run by the International Rescue Committee, or IRC, in partnership with UNICEF and WFP. At the clinic, children receive treatment for malnutrition, and their parents and guardians are instructed on the importance of proper nutrition. Musa Sakwon is a counselor at the center. He manages the infant and young child feeding program. Sakwon says nursing mothers come to the center twice a week for sessions on how to properly breastfeed their babies. Sakwon says at least 5 lactating mothers are admitted daily to Ganiel Nutrition Center. Too often, their children are suffering from acute malnutrition. Sakwon says the center is making efforts to raise awareness among lactating mothers on how to best to nourish their children. Sakwon says counselors are also trying to eliminate traditional practices that they say contribute to the rising cases of malnutrition in the county. For example, he says many mothers are unaware that they can breastfeed their newborn infants.
When the mother gives birth, immediately the child will be given a cow meal soon after birth. Another one, they have ideology that when the child is come out, they have to wait for the placenta to come out first.
In South Sudan, the problem of malnutrition does not just occur in rural conflict-stricken areas like Panyijar County. Al-Sabah Children's Hospital in Juba is one of the many pediatric health care centers in all of South Sudan. The hospital has started an intensive nutrition care program because even in the nation's capital, malnutrition is on the rise. Wani Moses is a nutritionist working at Al-Sabah. He says an average of 80 patients suffering either from moderate or acute malnutrition are admitted to the hospital every month.
The major causes, we can say, food insecurity. All these mothers, to say, who are actually taking care of these children, they don't have adequate food at their own home. So you find most of these mothers, their husbands are either soldiers, taken away for work, duties.
Moses says education on maintaining proper hygiene, family planning information, and awareness of child nutrition must be provided to parents and caregivers. Zeno Muhanga, the head of nutrition for the IRC, agrees that merely helping people who are already suffering from malnutrition is not enough.
There is more need of having other programs to scale up, like agriculture and the food security and the livelihood program. This needs to scale up in order to have the long-term solution for the malnutrition cases in our location. Because the programs which we are running, these are the short-term. They are not actually meant for the long-term solution.
For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
A growing number of children are being forced to beg on the streets of Dakar under the guise of attending alleged Quranic schools. Human Rights Watch recently released a report citing a number of abuses by adults claiming to be Quranic teachers. Charges include beating and forcing children to beg. Despite a 10-year-old ban on begging, the government found more than 30,000 boys forced to beg every day. HRW's West Africa researcher Felicity Thompson tells Ricky Shryak that Senegal needs to enforce rules against forced begging.
10 years ago, this month, Senegal passed a law to protect children from being forced to beg, which was a good law, but it has very rarely been put into action. We have found a handful of cases where Quranic school teachers who forced their students to beg were actually held to account and convicted of this crime. Regular cases of Talibé abuse are regular beatings, whipping with ropes or even metal cords, and a recent case in Saint Louis in March, where a 7-year-old boy had been chained with metal chains around his ankles to prevent him from running away from his Quranic school, which he had done several times to try and escape the abuses that he was suffering there.
Is it an issue of the government not having enough resources to investigate and properly prosecute these cases?
There is a question of resources, and the government putting enough resources into, for example, the anti-trafficking units that they set up to look at this problem. But also, you can walk anywhere on the street in Senegal and you can see Talibé begging quite openly in front of police and in front of, you know, public buildings. So you don't need resources to apply that law to investigate, you know, those children who are begging on the streets.
Where is the resistance coming from, do you think?
One of the main problems we found is opposition from religious leaders and social pressure. Because the Quranic schools are such a long tradition in Senegal, but the Quranic schools that we are talking about are not those traditional Quranic schools. They are their businesses that have been set up by people who aren't necessarily Quranic teachers, but under the guise of that institution, they are committing these crimes. Human Rights Watch has been researching this issue of abuses of Talibé for about 5 years. And despite, you know, some efforts by the government, there's really been little change since then. It's not a small problem, and it's not a problem that's going away. In fact, our recent research shows that it's a growing phenomenon.
The Quranic schools are not regulated in Senegal. There are efforts to pass a draft law in the Senegalese legislature right now that would regulate Quranic schools, but there is some speculation that that draft law might be abandoned after years of effort. What is the status of that draft law right now?
As far as the official status of the draft law to regulate daras or Quranic schools in Senegal, it's currently under consultation before going to the National Assembly.
Felicity Thompson is a West Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The votes have been counted and the results have been posted for the April 13th, 16th national elections in Sudan. Despite a wide-scale elections boycott, President Omar Hassan al-Bashir and his National Congress Party are claiming victory and a mandate for continued rule in the troubled East African nation. Voting was extended to address low voter turnout and problems in distributing ballot materials in some locations. But with many candidates dropping out of the races to protest restrictions on campaigning and the government's backtracking on an agreement to hold a national dialogue with the armed and unarmed opposition along with civil society to address the underlying causes of internal conflicts, turnout was reported to be low even as voting stretched into a fourth day. The United States and its Troika partners, Norway and the United Kingdom, regret the government of Sudan's failure to create a free, fair, and conducive elections environment. Restrictions on political rights and freedoms, counter to the rights enshrined in the Sudanese constitution, the lack of a credible national dialogue, and the continuation of armed conflict on Sudan's peripheries are among the reasons for the reported low participation and very low voter turnout. The outcome of these elections cannot be considered a credible expression of the will of the Sudanese people. We condemn the acts of violence during the elections period and continue to support those Sudanese who wish to peacefully advance a comprehensive and legitimate political process of dialogue toward an end to the conflict, meaningful governance reform, and long-term stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.